Дай вам несколько пар, помолиться при Врагакаче, если вы разрешите Бадиска Бадиша, если Бхакти Бхакти Сандаджи, Бхакти, Искан Фан Ачарья, Шла Прабхупада, Ана Джакути Вайшна Виндики, Нам Ачарья, Шла Хаида Спакули, Бенсе Его Сри Кришна Чайтанья Прабху Нитьяна, Души Адвейти Гранд Парши Басади Гоу, Бхакти Виндики, Шиши Радха, Кришна Гоу, Гопадина Шама Камбарадха, Виндики, Шри Vrindavan Namaki, Shri Mayapur Kamaki, Ganga Maiki, Jamuna Maiki, Bhakti Deviki, Tulasi Deviki, Samavita Bhakti Vrindaki, Jainita Gaur, all glories to Samavatis, all glories to Samavatis, all glories to Samavatis, all glories to Shri Guru and Shri Gauranga, all glories to Shri.
Evam sadharanam deham.
Employer, to the self, to the father, the mother, or the mother's father? Does it belong to the person who takes it away by force, to the slave master who purchases it, or to the sons who burn it in the fire? Or if the body is not burned, does it belong to the dogs that eat it? Among many possible claimants, who is the rightful claimant? Not to ascertain this, but instead to maintain the body by sinful activities is not good. This body, after all, is produced by the unmanifested nature, and again annihilated and merged in the natural elements. Therefore, it is the common property of everyone. Under the circumstances, who but a rascal claims his property to be his own, and while maintaining it, commits such sinful activities as killing animals just to satisfy his whims? Unless one is a rascal, one cannot commit such sinful activities. Purport. Atheists do not believe in the existence of the soul. Nonetheless, unless one is very cruel, why should one kill animals unnecessarily? The body is a manifestation of a combination of matter. In the beginning, it was nothing, but by a combination of matter, it has come into existence. Then again, when the combination is dismantled, the body will no longer exist. In the beginning, it was nothing, and in the end, it will be nothing. Why then should one commit sinful activities when it is manifested? It is not possible for anyone to do this unless he is rascal, number one. So here Narad Muni is pointing out the defect in the consciousness of the twins, Nalakubari and Manigriva. That they are considering themselves very special because of getting Lord Shiva's association. And in this, then their wealth, prestige, all this has increased. So, because of this, then, because of their pride, now they're taking advantage of it. They're trying to enjoy the facilities that they are getting from being an associate now of Lord Shiva. So, next to Kailash Hill is the Mandakini River. So generally most people go to the Ganga to purify themselves, but these rascals, they are going there, you know, for their own purposes, you know, to further enjoy themselves, take advantage of the kindness of Ganga Devi. So Narad Muni seeing all this, then he wants to correct it. This is the importance of chastisement. Chastisement must correct. If it doesn't correct, then it either shouldn't be applied or the method has to be changed. Because the goal of correction, I mean of chastisement, is correction. And correction by what standard? How far does that correction have to go? So Narad Muni gives the example, Krishna consciousness. So if the chastisement doesn't ultimately result in Krishna consciousness by a tangible, I say, method or path, then it's not proper. It means chastisement must be there, but one has to think of it to the point that it comes to the level of Krishna consciousness. That is correct. Otherwise, something less. It solves a managerial problem, it solves somebody's emotional problem, it solves some intellectual problem. But unless it solves the whole problem and brings one to Krishna consciousness, then it's not actually a solution, it would just create another problem. Right? We see this in the modern context, is that people try to solve modern day problems, but in doing it they create another problem. So that's not a solution. Solution means it must remove the problem and further one towards Krishna consciousness. It shouldn't create another problem. Otherwise, then it's not correct. Right? It means there will always be obstacles in the material world. But obstacles are natural. Right? It means if one is managing, it means you're managing away basically the obstacles and giving direction to people where they're going, so that they are able to avoid obstacles or are able to handle obstacles. So the whole thing is you're trying to give them Krishna consciousness. Right? So that is also the purpose, is to Krishna consciousness. So all training, all chastisement, all direction, correction must bring about Krishna consciousness. So Narad Muni is giving a perfect example here. So we see is that he can give the basis on what is the problem. He's identifying the problem. Then he's going to get a suitable result for that. With that ends in Krishna consciousness. Here he's seeing the brothers that they are, just by looking at them, he can understand what's going on. They become bewildered by Shiva's place, you know, and the facility. It's not hard for Narad Muni to understand, because Lord Shiva is his brother. You know, he moves in those realms, so he can understand. He's always dealing with all kinds of persons, materialists and spiritualists, so he can tell what is the purpose of why people are doing what they're doing. So then seeing this, their pride and their riches, then he's pointing out that the body also, we can see, is a property, something we can call riches. But pointing out here is that the body, being temporary, then that's one is a problem. Two is, who can be proud of it? That's his question here. Means, we will say, I can be proud of it, it's my body, but he's just listed a whole bunch of people here that can claim, right? Belong to the employer, means you work for somebody, so he gets you to do what he wants, and then he pays you for that. But you have to do what he wants, that means you belong to him. Right? You would say, no, I belong to myself, then just do what you want. Why do you have to do what he wants? No, to do what you may say, no, but I want to do that. Yes, but in doing that, basically you sell your body to the other person. That's what he's buying. Right? You go to the job from 9 to 5, you're selling your body, your mind, your intelligence, all the material elements that you claim as yours to the other person, and then he pays you for it, for using it for that much time. Right? If the employer is 24 hours, then he bought you the full time. If not, then a third of your day. So how can you claim this is mine? Right? To the self, then we'll say, yes, belongs to the soul. Okay, so that's... But is that our actual claimant? Are we claiming it because we are the soul? Because if we are the soul, then we're not the body. Why do we identify with the body? We can claim it, but why do we identify with it? If we're identifying with it, then we can't say that, no, it belongs to the soul. Because it belongs to the soul, it belongs to the soul. We don't identify with it. Right? Then to the father or the mother, right? Because the father has given us the body, so it belongs to him. or the mother, she's the field where it was nurtured, the body, so then she could claim she's the proprietor of the body. Or here, what's not used so much nowadays, the mother's father. It may be that the mother is an appointed daughter. Right? The father, the grandfather has no son. So someone has to perform his Shraddha rites. So he appoints his daughter as Putrika, so her son will be the one who performs the rites. So that means his body belongs to him. Right? Not even to the mother or father. He belongs to the grandfather. The mother's grand. The mother is the father. Like that. Who takes it away by force? You can say it's my body, but another person comes and picks you up, locks you up, and sticks you someplace. So how is it you can say it's your body? They're going to do with you what they like. They want to tie you up. They want to, you know, they want to feed you, not feed you. What they want to do, they'll do with you. So how do you say it's my body? It's their body, right? One can contest. No, it's very obvious that it's mine, you know, because I have possession. No, they have possession. Right? Why is something, it's in your house, it's in your possession, then you'll say it is mine, right? But where did you get it from? From the shop? Okay. Then you can say, I paid money for it. Where did the shop get it from? Some other shop, where did they get it from? They got it from nature. Who paid nature? Right? Unless the transaction is complete, it's stolen goods. Right? Your furniture is taken from the forest. Right? Who paid the forest? Right? The moon is in charge of trees. Who paid the moon? Right? Raise your hands. Who paid the moon? Right? Nobody. Right? So, unless you perform the Vedic rites to pay the moon, it's not your furniture. It's his furniture. Right? Or you are devoting your Krishna consciousness, you're using that furniture in Krishna's service. Krishna is the Lord of the moon, so therefore now. But then you could say, no, but it still is Krishna's property. So that way then if that thing is who has possession is there, then who controls your body by force, it's theirs. Right? You can't say, well, I have this, so it's mine, but they have me, but I'm not theirs. Right? You may say, well, I have soul, so therefore, but the soul is different from the body. And this watch, it isn't controlled by someone who's in charge of time or mechanics. They have a soul. It's separated from them. They're in charge of it. I may say I'm in charge of it. So we can see is that from this, it just gets, you know, very complicated. You know, then the body is your body, but you're going to leave it. You're going to walk away. Even you say, no, no, it's the soul's body. Then it comes down to, okay, and then when you die, whose body is it? Either it'll be consumed by the fire gets the body, right? Or the dogs or the worms get the body. So if it's yours, you should be able to take it with you. But we can't. So then, therefore, our claimant that the soul is not ours either. Nor the mother, nor the father, they don't get it either. So this becomes very complicated if we really think about it. So that's his point, is that someone who contemplates this, then can get somewhere. Because then we're not overwhelmed by wealth. Right? The body is a wealth. It's something we have. It's property. Right? It's not us, so therefore it's property. So as property, then we become proud of it. I have better property. My property is better than your property. Right? Like that. You know, like this. We can go on. My arrangement of mucus, bile, and air is better than your arrangement of mucus, bile, and air. You know, so like this, we can. These are the aspects of contemplation here. So Narada Muni is trying to point this out to the brothers, that because of your attachment to the body, identifying with the body, and therefore becoming proud of that, and the facilities that go along with it, the position, the prestige, all these things, then you become bewildered. And being bewildered, then you're engaging yourself in activities that should not be engaged in. You're going to the Ganga for sense gratification. That shouldn't be happening. Right? You're there naked. You shouldn't be naked. You know, you don't go out naked in public. Right? Not only that, you're there with ladies, you know, and they're naked. At least they're smart enough to put on their clothes when they're naked. They're not. So that shows they're really proud, that they're really confident that they belong in that garden, that no one can remove them from that. Plus, they're intoxicated. So you add all this up, and this is a result of their pride and wealth and position. So from that, then they have gotten into this trouble. So Narada Muni is pointing this all out to them. Before he curses them, he's going to point this all out to them so that it's very nicely understood. Because otherwise, how will one be reformed if one doesn't understand what is wrong? Right? And the problem that you're doing is going all the way back to the philosophy. Right? So he's pointing out you're performing sinful activities. Right? Because you think that it's good for your body, because you own the body, but actually who owns the body? And if you're separate from the body, then why you would get into all this? Simply for some temporary thing that's going to land you in trouble. So pointing all that out to them, then he will correct them. So this is the process of correction. Well, yeah, it takes it further, is that unmanifested nature. This means all the elements of the body go back into the unmanifested nature, into the pradhan. They just become part of the, you know, this, and then they get put somewhere else. They become someone else's body. So what today is one person's body becomes another person's body tomorrow. Today it's a vegetable, then tomorrow it's, you know, sabji, and then the next day you eat it, it becomes your body, right? So it just keeps changing like that. That's all. You breathe out, and then what you breathe out, the plants breathe in, and that makes their body. What they breathe out is what you breathe in, and makes your body. So, therefore, the body is common property. It belongs to everybody. You know, so all these considerations like that. So, Baba's pointing, and Narada Muni is pointing out here, is therefore only a rascal can for the body perform sinful activities. Right? That for the pleasure of their body, that they could perform sinful activities. Otherwise it wouldn't be done. It's just, it's not proper. It just wouldn't be, it's not an option. So if one is not a rascal, then one understands that these things are, you know, that there's something higher here, there's a higher purpose. There's Krishna consciousness. So there, then one will look at this from that angle and try to identify and remove the rascalness that's there. It's whoever's in the material world, except persons like Narada Muni, it's here because of some degree of rascalness. So one must identify that and remove it. Any questions or comments? Yes.
If you could elaborate on more on that, when somebody is chastising somebody, then there is different mood can happen. There can be different way of chastising, different moods also. And Narada Muni here was out of compassion. So then it was, had a nice result and this and that, but it's not properly done out of anger or out of envy and this kind of things, and it gives different results.
Okay, so question is there.
What is the proper way of chastising? What is the proper mood?
Question is then, what is the proper attitude in chastising? Because here we see as Narada Muni is doing it out of compassion. Others could do it from some other angle. So if you're taking it back to be able to perform it properly, it has to be connected back to Krishna. That means that it has to be connected to the philosophy, from the philosophy down to the culture. Right? So either it's a philosophical problem or it's a cultural problem. Right? That's the point. Now, culture here, meaning I'm taking as application of that philosophy in all branches of, you know, one's existence. That we're not taking culture, meaning either what you put into, you know, a pot of, you know, loop, you know, how you say, room temperature milk or that you go to the theater for. We're talking about the lifestyle. So that means your ashram and occupational duties. Because both of them have to be culture and both of them have to be based on the philosophy. Otherwise, there's no consistency there. So, if it's philosophical, then that is dealt with, because if the philosophy is wrong, that means one won't be able to properly make spiritual advancement, because there'll be a difficulty in either understanding of your relationship with the Lord or one's how to perform or what one's goal in life is or how to perform the activities to attain that goal. So then that has to be dealt with on that level. You know, so it's just referring to that. The other is that the performance of that relationship process or goal being applied practically in your life is wrong. So then it needs to be corrected. So if that's seen and you understand the standard, then you have this aspect of compassion in that, because the idea is they should advance spiritually. So that means compassion, because technically you should only be chastising a dependent or a junior. Like that. One doesn't chastise seniors. One doesn't chastise equals. You know, one may work with them. One may try to point things out, but still one doesn't chastise. That's not culture. Right? It doesn't work like that. It's rasa bas. So one chastises dependents. So then one is supposed to be kind to dependents. So it's part of kindness, is training them properly. So that's why Mother Yashoda is chastising Krishna, because it is against the principles of, you know, elevated, refined human life, what he's doing. So then she wants to correct him so that his life will be prosperous. It'll be, you know, auspicious. That's the purpose there. And Narad Muni also wants to see that the life of the Nalapudara and Manigriva is auspicious. Because Kuvera. Okay, now Kuvera is somebody else's son. He's somebody else's son. So they're like grand nephews or like that. Grand or great grand. You know, so they're pretty close. So he wants to benefit them. Not because of the family relationship, but because they're moving those circles. They're moving now in Shiva's circle. That's also a circle he moves in. That's why he would know. He's going to see his brother. They go and they sit and they discuss Krishna conscious topics. So then here, then he comes by them in his walk, you know, because generally one is going to this place, these gardens here, to go take one's bath in the Ganga and for meditation and sadhana and, you know, religious purposes. So it's a little out of character that they're engaging in sense gratification in such a nice place. Right? That's why, you know, Prabhupada mentions that Krishna covers the Dham and doesn't make it look as attractive, because the materialists will come there. It's the nicest place, but if it's so nice, then it'll be turned into a resort. Right? Somebody will be making money off of it, you know. Does that make sense? You know, it'll become, you know, Trump weed or something, you know, like that. You know, 9 different, unique, holy, you know, vacation spots for your pleasure. You know, all these kind of things. So, to avoid that, the Lord makes it look not as attractive. You know, like that. Something that is not good for the senses. Therefore, the materialist won't come. Like that. That is there. Like it mentions that Govardhan is the, I say, of any place, it's the hottest place of any, any place where people live. There's hotter places where no one lives. You know, it gets up to 60 degrees in some places, in some desert. No one lives there. But actually, inhabited place, it's the hottest spot on the planet. So it's also the highest spot on the planet. Therefore, Krishna makes it, you know, only those who are really serious. It means that someone who doesn't mind dying from the heat, then they live there. If you're worried about dying from the heat, then it's definitely not the place for you. So, So that mood of compassion always has to be there. But to be compassionate, one has to know the standard, and one has to have character oneself. That's why it says, don't become a mother, father, teacher, unless you can save the dependence from death. This is the meaning. It's whatever your guidance, your direction, your example, you have to show them how to save themselves. Does that make some sense?
I don't understand. The movie seems to be speaking about the sin and the rest of them killing animals. Why does he point that out? It doesn't seem related to what they're doing.
Okay, so question is, why is he pointing out the sin towards killing animals, eating animals, you know, instead of pointing out what they are doing? It's, one, it's all connected. If you can do one, the others can't follow very easily. Because then from intoxication and these things, you know, that's ignorance being absorbed and associated with women, that's passion. So in those modes, then that's naturally food for someone in passion and ignorance. That's one aspect. The another aspect is, if you're going to chastise someone, sometimes you use the thing that they've done. Sometimes you use something related. It means, in other words, what's going on is sin. You choose another sin, a third party sin to deal with. Many times that's also easier. But you have to be dealing with people who are subtle enough to catch it. You know, so they're quite, you know, smart. So they should be able to catch the connection. Does that make sense? So, because if you talk directly about what they're doing, then it's a matter of what's wrong with it, or they have so many excuses, or this or that. You take a third-party example, then that is neutral for them, because that they're not doing. But the teachings of that and the principles of that apply to their situation. So it's a very effective way of dealing like that. Because if you deal first party, then generally the tendency, or second party, you know, first party is what's wrong with me, if the second party was who do you think you are, so you deal third party, right? And you have to pick a third party that's not going to create an us or them. Because you want to, the idea is you're trying to go above duality. The problem is duality. So you want to go something else that's not going to create, the neutral one. And then on that, then you can instruct through to that. You know, it's just like Prabhupada says, chastising the daughter to correct the daughter-in-law. Like that. Because if you directly chastise the daughter-in-law, it may be taken otherwise. You chastise the daughter because of the you don't have that relationship with the daughter-in-law yet. When it's there, you can chastise directly. But until that time, you have a relationship with the daughter, so you can say what you want there. Right? There's always some fine point. There's always something more to be learned. So you can use that, and then from that small thing, expand it out into exactly what you want to tell the daughter-in-law. But because it's not her, it's the sister, then it's not a problem for her. Then afterwards, they'll go and they'll talk, wow, that was, you know, this and that. Does that make some sense? So it's a technique. It's a gentle, because gentleness is important. But at the same time, gentleness is also there for those who can deal with it. Like that. Because that's the first choice. The first choice is gentleness. If gentleness doesn't work, then one goes to stronger, you know, situations. Because the point is it must be corrected. Right? Something that's not proper has to be corrected. Like that. Then one just has to see if one is oneself is the proper, you know, how you say, office for that correction, or if it actually is someone else's office. So, anything else?
Not only is speaking all these things, so fifth possibly, how is he speaking all these things to somebody who's not talking to you, but they're not talking about themselves?
Uh-huh. Okay, the question is now they're intoxicated, do they actually understand what he's saying? There is such a thing as if there's something very shocking that somehow or another momentarily pulls one out of the drunkenness. You know, this is what we have heard. I can't speak from experience. You know, like somebody's in a situation of a cold water in the face or, you know, something like this. So when Narad Muni suddenly walks in and you're standing there naked, you know, and you know that you shouldn't be doing what you're doing in that situation, generally the shock would be enough probably to bring one to one's senses. The point was is when he walked in, there was enough opportunity for him to have gotten out, then to get out of the water, cover themselves up like the girls did. And then he might just make some light thing. You know, it's like, you know, you should be more careful with this. You know, like this. He would make some more general thing. It wouldn't be your curse necessarily. It's just of being understanding what's appropriate. So he might have discussed the same things, but on a lighter level without any curse. But since that first him coming into the situation, they were so proud. So it was more their pride. The drunkenness in pride was more than their intoxication with whatever the Varuni. That's more, because the girls are also drinking Varuni, and they were getting out of the water. Why do you think they're not going to drink Varuni? The point is that they were such nice girls, you think they'd be down there with some guy naked in the gun.
Also, Narad Muni called them also indirectly as a killer, so one who is killing people, and also one who is eating meat, basically.
So I think by using the word jantu.
So.
Yeah, jantu is poor animals. I guess that's it. Remember, there used to be a dog in the guru pool called jantu.
And I think also would make them up immediately.
Yeah, sort of like that. All these different things. These are all techniques. It's the language that's used, the tone of voice, the topic, all that. So that means all these things are to be learned. Otherwise, it's not just a story. It's not just philosophy. Generally, we relegate the Bhagavatam to these two things. Nice stories, a great philosophy. But the point is it's that and also the application in our life. So you want to know how to correct somebody, here's an example, like that. It means whatever there is in our life, day-to-day life, there's an example of it in the Bhagavatam. It's all there, but it's on the topmost level. So then setting that as a goal, then we try to make those steps to get there. That's always there. And to affect that getting there, then we have the example here, so we know what we're looking for, and we have the instructions of the Gita. So we know how to move forward. Some other questions?
So, one of the extensions of doing devotional service is that you cannot be stopped by any material means. But you see, Prabhupada's programming, if there's nothing else, it's designed to bring us to the world of goodness. He also says that we should avoid passion and ignorance. So it seems there's some dependence on the mode of goodness to come to cure those, to cure ourselves. So how is it not being
Not being dependent? How is devotional service independent of the mode of goodness? Means it's like this. The devotional service, it's not when you're in devotional service, when you're performing devotional service, that you're on the transcendental platform, then you're in devotional service. Then those moments when you're not in the devotional platform, it's not a problem for devotional service. Right? It's a problem for us. Right? So let us say that you have a building, a tall building, right? A 10-floor building. You know, so we put transcendental devotional service on the 10th floor. Okay. So now when you're doing devotional service, you're there. And then when you're not, you know, you step out the window and, you know, hit the ground. And then you go, well, I don't know about this. And then you climb back all the way up the stairs, do a little more service, and then fall out the window again. Okay, so what's being recommended is the devotional service, it doesn't matter. for you, it would be easier that, you know, if you're not doing devotional service and stay on the ninth floor. So when you want to do devotional service, then you only have that far to go. Does that make, is that, because goodness and pure goodness, the difference is that goodness still has motive behind it. While pure goodness means unmotivated. So you're performing the goodness because it's less trouble. Right? It means impersonalism is that we don't want any trouble. So when we don't want trouble, that's impersonalism. Right? Just like you have managers that don't want problems. But management means problems. It's just like saying, I want a dog that doesn't bark, wag its tail, you know, walk on four legs, you know, lick you on the face, or shed hair. Right? Then that's like saying, you don't want a dog. Right? You know, get something else, you know, get a mosquito or something. Oh, yeah, you get a pet cricket. Yeah, the Chinese are the pet crickets. They don't shed, they don't bark. Well, they do chirp. You know what I'm saying? So like that, or get a Winnie the Pooh doll or something. They don't give me anything. They just sit there. You know, something like that. So, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, it goes with it. Management knows it. He just manages the problems, because that's what it means. But the person who doesn't want to do it, then it's, that's the aspect of the impersonalism. Because it goes with the thing. You know, you don't like, you know, the kids, the way they behave. It's kids. Don't have kids. Don't deal with kids. You know, you don't like the way women and men behave. Don't deal with them. That's the way they are. Does that make some sense? So then, that's another thing. To bring someone to the correct platform, it's a matter of you have a standard that's Krishna consciousness. That's another topic. But trying to avoid the problem, that's one of the elements of impersonalism. But that's also the mode of goodness. Because you see the problem, so that means you have knowledge. Right? While in passion and ignorance, you don't really see them. Well, if you do, they're just part of the thing. And so, because you have something else you're trying to get to. You don't mind them. Does that make some sense? So mode of goodness is then, it's the platform of knowledge. And so from knowledge, it's much easier to get to transcendence than it is from material desire and attachment. That's the thing. From the platform of anger or lust, it's very hard to get to transcendence. But from knowledge, it's easier to get to transcendence. But devotional service isn't dependent upon any of that. It's dependent upon the desire to want to perform it. Right? Devotional service comes from devotional service. You want to perform devotional service. That itself is devotional service. So then that gives rise to more devotional service. You do devotional service, you get more devotional service. Right? So it doesn't come from any mundane cause. Generally, we like to think that, well, I was very philosophical or I was very religious. It's none of that. It has nothing to do with the reason we joined. It's just causeless mercy that the Lord, we wanted to know about God or why, or there was some reason that we were dissatisfied with material existence. And we wanted to know if there's something more. Right? And so that itself then put us in contact with the bona fide devotees. That's how we know. One may say, well, but I wanted to know. But one was inspired to know because everything that you put your faith in is being, you know, systematically broken down by the modes of nature. So everything you put your faith in that you think is going to make you happy, that's going to, you know, do anything for you, is systematically being broken down by the material energy at every moment. So at some point, then you just go, well, what is going on here? So even Krishna, it still causes mercy because he arranges the modes that they do that. Right? And then you say, well, I put myself in this situation so I could take advantage of that. But that we can't take credit for either, because that means we're just being stupid. right? It means Krishna is there, we need to surrender to him, but instead we decide to go through the material nature and get kicked around for a while. You know, we want to go and play rugby with the material energy and we're the ball. Right? So then, right? So that kind of thing. So it's not okay, we can get credit for really being stupid and somehow or another Krishna is able to engage us like that. So it becomes very difficult. So we see it's devotional service is not dependent. It's coming through the devotees. And from the devotees, we see them doing devotional service. We hear from them about devotional service. They engage us in devotional service. And devotional service gives devotional service. Any activity done gives rise to the opportunity to do it again. Right? So that's the transcendence. On the material platform, you do a material activity, it gives rise for the opportunity to do it again. So even when you decide, okay, I'm not going to do this anymore, because you've already done it, then the opportunity to do it again is going to come up automatically. So sometimes someone will say, well, why does Krishna allow this? No, it's not Krishna allowed it, you allowed it. You did it, so the result will come, the opportunity will be there to do it again. Now when you don't do that activity in that situation, then it's gone. Right? If you don't work, you don't get any result. Right? You don't go to the office for a week, you don't get paid for the week. Right? So the situation will come, but you don't take it. Then it's gone. But it will always come up again. Because you've done it. So same way as you've done devotional service, the opportunity to do that will always come up again. And then if we take it, then again. And if we don't take it, then that will be lost. And then another angle. Because devotional service depends on devotional service. So we're given devotional service. Does that make some sense? You know, fire is coming from fire. But once it's there, this fire can light more fire. You know. Is that okay? Anything else? This one. Rantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Srimad Prabhupada ki. Samadita Bhaktivedya ki. Jayatana Govinda.